Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service to public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on homeschooling right after this. Well, let me ask you this question. What do you think is wrong with the Ten Commandments? It's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they have been banned from our public schools, banned from our public institutions, and banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these ten simple time-tested laws, we see the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in their stead or in their place. And they teach the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, our public institutions. We Americans have made them part of our national psyche. Now, this is a very radical change in our political and moral outlook, don't you think, over the past 50 years? Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school without even your knowledge, much less your consent? Now, that's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Now, let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. Our founding fathers practiced and they advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's at least one school left in America that still teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, along with the penalties and the 33 benefits that we receive for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty. You don't have to know what that penalty is to suffer its effect. So whether you call that the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, the Common Law, Natural Law, or Karma, or something else, it's automatic. It works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Remember, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, why don't you go to the website, georgegordon.org. Then click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time I said we'd take a look at some solutions. What are the benefits that you get from educating your child in your own home school? Well, for $546 a year, that's the price that we're paying currently for our homeschool program, $546 a year, here's what you get. You get to put God back into your child's classroom. It was the government that took God out of the classroom. Why don't you put God right back into the classroom, live and direct yourself? You can put prayer back into your child's life and classroom in your own school. Your own home school. You can put morality back into your child's classroom and back into your child's life with your home school. You can put premarital sexual abstinence back into your child's classroom. I know it's a wild new idea. It's called sexual abstinence. You can teach your child that sex belongs in marriage, not in the back seat of some pimply-faced punk's car. I know that's a wild new concept, too. You can furnish your child with moral guidance in a homeschool in place of condoms in public school. You can furnish your child with a good moral environment in your own homeschool in place of an abortion. Why don't you teach your children responsibility and responsible behavior in place of sexual relations among adolescents? You can teach your own children in your own home school your morals and your moral standards and your values, and stop employing pedophiles and sodomites to teach your children their morals and their perversions. Why don't you teach the science of the Bible in place of the evolutionary fairy tales that are being taught in public school to your children? Real science in place of fairy tales. You can teach the Constitution of the United States to your children in place of communism. You can teach your child the Bill of Rights instead of socialism. You can put the Ten Commandments into your homeschool classroom, and you can throw out the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. Now, if you don't want to educate a child, you shouldn't have one. If you have a child that you don't want to educate, then put that child into private school. Choose a private school. You can follow these 16 steps and your home school will have none of these problems, such as rape, robbery, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, murder, suicide, absenteeism, vandalism, extortion, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, gang warfare, teen pregnancy, abortion, or VD. You can eliminate all of that in your own home school. You know, 40% of children fear for their safety in public school. You can eliminate that fear in your own home school. You can put a stop to your children carrying weapons to school. And you can put a stop to it in your own home school. Your child will never again be one of the 40% of students who have been the victims of robbery, assault, or larceny in the public school. You can end that in your own home school. You can eliminate the robbery, larceny, and assault on teachers by yourself in your own home school. You can single-handedly stop all of the physical attacks on teachers in your own home school. And you can reestablish absolutes. You can establish right and wrong in your home school. And you too can alter every aspect of morality, behavior, and achievement in your own home school. You can raise your child's achievement scores, which have been declining in public school since 1963. You can set a goal of graduating one literate child from your home school in place of the 1 million illiterate children that graduate from our public schools every year. Keep in mind that those 1 million illiterates are 1 million illiterates compared to today's literacy standards, of which 50% of Americans today are barely literate. Barely literate. You can teach your child that Mexico borders the United States on the south. You can teach your child the names of the 6 New England states, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. You can get real wild. You know, after you teach your child the names of those 6 New England states, you can teach them to learn the capitals of those 6 New England states, which are Providence, Boston, Hartford, Montpelier, Concord, and Augusta. You know how you do that? You can go online with your computer. In contrast to the 45% of public school children, why don't you teach your child the shape of the United States on a map and have him or her color it in? You can teach your child that Texas and Alaska are the two largest states in the Union. And while you're at it, why don't you teach your children or your child all 50 states and their capitals in the Union? When I was a child, that was a requirement to go from the 5th to the 6th grade. In order for you to get out of the 3rd grade and go to the 4th grade, you had to be able to write. in order to get out of the fourth grade, or the third grade, excuse me, the fourth grade into the fifth grade, you had to know your times tables from 1 to 12. To get out of the fifth grade to go to the sixth grade, you had to be able to name all of the states and all of their capitals. You know, you can put those kinds of standards into your own home school. Did you know that 80% of public school students can't tell you the names of the two smallest states? That's right. Couldn't tell you the names of the two smallest states. They're Rhode Island with 1,026 square miles and Delaware with 2,057 square miles. And don't forget the state capitals, Providence and Dover. Your child will be in a small minority of 20% of the high school graduates who know that Rhode Island and Delaware are the smallest states in the Union. And that when he or she takes that entry-level test with the New York Telephone Company, they will be in the top 20% of applicants to the phone company after they graduate from your home school. They're not going to learn that in public school. 67% of public school students, remember this, 67% of public school students did not know when the Civil War took place. Well, it was 1861 to 1865. Teach that to your child, and they will be in the top one-third. One-third. Top one-third of American high school students. Now, that little piece of information will place your homeschooled child in the top one-third of the nation's history students. And by the way, Abraham Lincoln was president during the same 5 years, 1861 to 1865. Remember, 75% of public high school students did not know that either. You know, these are things that we had to know when I was a child going to school, or we couldn't go from one grade to the next. There were certain minimum standards. Now, they're talking about putting these standards back in public school. But how can you reform something as wicked and evil as the public school system is that I have been reporting to you over the past 2 weeks? And I started off and I said, let me show you how wicked and evil public school is. And then I said, let me show you how good homeschool is. Give me liberty or give me death. And that came from a fellow by the name of Patrick Henry. Do you remember that? Patrick Henry. 50% of public school children did not know that. You should be sure to teach those seven famous words to your child in your own home school. Give me liberty or give me death. And while we're talking about famous quotations, did you know that it was Abraham Lincoln that was the author of the Emancipation Proclamation? Well, a third of public school children didn't know that. As soon as you teach your child, Abraham Lincoln was the author of the Emancipation Proclamation, your homeschool child will have something that a third of public school children don't know. The Constitution was written in 1787, the Declaration of Independence in 1776, George Washington was commander of the Colonial Army, and the Declaration of Independence was the signal for our break with England. Now, 20 to 50% of public school children don't know that. They don't know those simple historical facts that you can teach in your home school to your child. You should employ honest, moral, trustworthy, intelligent, and competent teachers in your home school. You should hire yourself. And that's because you are, without a doubt, the best qualified teacher that your child could ever have. There's no one that can replace you, Mom and Dad, as your child's teacher. Now, pays to study directly, and it confronts an oft-heard criticism of home schooling, that parents are unqualified to teach and that certified teachers are absolutely necessary. The study shows there is no difference in the scores of students taught by a parent who is or once was a certified teacher and those parents who are truck drivers, housewives, and never been certified. Now, studies show, I'm going to repeat that, studies show directly And it confronts this often heard criticism of homeschooling, and that are that parents, or that is that parents are unqualified to teach, and that certified teachers are necessary. The study showed conclusively that there was no difference, zero, no difference in the scores of students who were taught by parents who did have teaching credentials and those who were taught by truck drivers and housewives. When you buy or when you subscribe to a homeschooling program, that program for the $546, we happened to buy it because it was computerized for our children, our daughter. We bought it because it was computerized, and she can learn at her own skill level, at what she is interested in doing. She can put history in, and she can learn history. She can learn history of the United States. She can learn history of all the countries of the world. She can learn history or geography or science, whatever interests her. And you'll find that when people become interested in something, they want to know. And when people are interested and they want to know something, they will ask questions. And when they've got a computer program, and they can ask those questions in the computer of the computer program, they go to that computer program and get those answers. Our daughter, our last daughter, this is our 12th child now that we've raised. We didn't have that many total, but we raised a bunch of grandchildren here. And this last one was scoring at the 12th grade level when she was 12 years old. In the 7th grade, scoring at the 12th grade level in a homeschool environment. That's not an exception. That's the norm. That's the norm. And you don't have to be a certified teacher with a credential to achieve that kind of results. Remember that. Now, parents who teach homeschool turn out students at the 87th percentile, 60% higher than public school teachers whose students score at the 50th percentile. 60% higher. You truck drivers, you moms and dads, you plumbers and carpenters and electricians that have been deceived into believing that if you don't have a teaching credential, you can't teach your child. Nonsense. Homeschooled children, on average, turn out at the 87th percentile. Some higher, some lower. But get this. Can you score worse than the 50th percentile? That's the national average in public school. Now, if your child is going to an inner-city public school like Detroit or Los Angeles or Philadelphia, the average is 28th percentile. Mom and Dad, you got to be awful damn dumb, awful incompetent to score that low in a homeschool. Now, you may not have the greatest education in the world yourself. You may be one of the 50% that's marginally literate. Why don't you call the law school and ask for some guidance? Let us tell you where to go to get more information on educating your child on a computer program. Buy a computer. They're as cheap as $300 brand new at Walmart. I just got some numbers in the other day. Chinese computers made by Dell, shipped into the United States for $300. Now, we're spending about $550 to $650 a year. Our daughter now is 17 years old. She could enroll in a college program if she so desired. We're not sure that college is all it's cracked up to be. We think that we can teach our child to be smarter, think better, be better educated than college level without wasting the time, and certainly without being compromised morally or politically in public education or public college. All right. That's the advantages to homeschool. Now listen, let's suppose that you've got a child and you're thinking about sending that child off to college. Did you know that instead of compromising your child, or if you want to learn, you want to get a college degree, you want to get a piece of paper that says you're smart, no time for college, no money, getting a degree doesn't necessarily mean sitting in classes on a college campus for 4 years. Jacqueline Westfall, who lives in New Mexico, earned her bachelor's degree from a university in Maryland without leaving town. At home, Westfall videotaped television courses offered through the University of Maryland University College, then watched them at her convenience. And according to the National University Continuing Education Association, nearly 392,000 Americans were enrolled in independent study courses during the 1992-93 academic year, with more than 60% pursuing college coursework. You got that? Now that's nearly 400,000 people. More than half of them, 200,000, are pursuing college coursework at home. There's computer programs that do the same thing. While tuition for distance learning courses often is the same per semester hour as for traditional courses, other savings make it a good alternative, at least a good alternative for many non-traditional schoolers. For instance, students don't have to quit their jobs to attend classes. They're often eliminated. The additional costs of child care or transportation when they're doing classwork at home are eliminated. Room and board is eliminated. Here's a sampling of other non-traditional college credit plans. 3-year degree programs. Some U.S. colleges and universities are streamlining their programs to help students spend less time and less money on their degrees. Upper Iowa University offers all of its majors on a 3-year track. About 10% of its student body now participate in this program. Over the course of 3 years, their total savings will be the amount of 1 year's tuition, $9,000 back in 1993. Cooperative education, co-op plans, usually extensions of traditional degree programs, refer students to cooperating employers. Students spend quarters or semesters away from campus working in areas pertinent to their majors. At Northeastern University in Boston, a typical rotation schedule requires 12 weeks on campus and 12 weeks on the job. Students don't pay tuition during their work terms, and they're paid competitive salaries when they're working. In addition to the financial compensation, students gain valuable experience in their fields of interest, become more proficient in interviewing and resume writing, and get a firsthand look at whether they've chosen the right major. Now, that's just some. Now, have you ever heard of a girl or a young woman by the name of Leanne Rimes? Well, she was, this is years ago now, when she was 14 years old, she was a homeschooled student. Rimes has been homeschooled since the 6th grade and is now working at the 10th grade level, 2 years ahead of most kids her age. She completes her school assignments while maintaining a performance schedule that includes more than 100 concert appearances a year. Now, that's when Leanne Rimes was 14 years old. Doing 100 concerts a year, and she was homeschooled. And, of course, it's necessary to be homeschooled, isn't it? I mean, after all, how is she going to spend time in school when she's traveling all over the country? You know, where there's a will, there's a way. Now, here's another story concerning this homeschool versus public school. Remember the fellow I told you about? His name is David W. Kirkpatrick. Well, in report number 691, dealing with school choice, he's a senior education fellow. You can go to their website. It's www.freedomfoundation.us. It's an easy one, www.freedomfoundation.us. Called School Choice, a Moral Imperative. In its 1925 Pierce versus Society of Sisters decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that an Oregon voter-approved initiative requiring all children to be educated only in a public school was unconstitutional. Right, so I'm going to underline that. Oregon, back in 1925, enacted a law, and they said, all children have to be educated in public school. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Pierce versus Society of Sisters decision, ruled that it was unconstitutional. If one of the more famous statements in the court's history, it said, the child is not the mere creature of the state. Your child, boys and girls, is not the mere creature of the state. Now, your public school administrators would like you to believe that it is, and that you have to send that child to public school or go to jail. But the Supreme Court and the law of the land say exactly the opposite. Now, if somebody's trying to intimidate you, that happens once in a while. Sometimes you'll run into an overzealous public school administrator. And they get kind of excited, and they'll threaten or they'll intimidate you. Well, if that happens, and somebody's trying to intimidate you, why don't you bring them back down to earth and cite the law to them? Now, the question of how to pay for a child's education in a setting other than public school was not before the court and therefore wasn't considered in that case. That's been a key issue during the school choice debate of recent years. Many school choice opponents say that they object to paying taxes to educate children in a non-public school, particularly a religious school. If they are sincere in this argument, they should grant this same right to others. That is, those objecting to public schools should not be compelled to pay taxes to support them. You know, if the sauce is good for the goose, it ought to be good for the gander. A variation of this argument is that those who want to educate their children other than in public schools should have to pay for it. But what if they can't pay for it? And I'm going to interject something right here because I want to tell you, boys and girls, if you're poor, if you're the working poor of America, you pay for public education. This concept, the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, this concept of free education for all children in public schools is nonsense. When you pay your rent, let me assure you, as a landlord who pays the public school tax in Ozark County, let me assure you, you renters, you are paying your full share for the free education of all children in public schools, because I, the landlord, am adding it into your rent. If you think that I, the landlord, am paying the public school tax and not passing it on to you, the renter, you're out of touch with reality. If you believe, boys and girls, that education, the public school system of education, is free in America, you've got your head up the wrong end of your anatomy. Let me assure you that you are paying your full share. When that tax is assessed to McDonald's, that tax is added to the price of a Big Mac. And every time you buy a Big Mac, rest assured that you're paying your full share of the public school tax. Boys and girls, business does not pay these taxes. You, the consumers, are paying it. Now, it may be that you're not paying it directly, that you're not writing a check, and you're not sending it in to the county assessor, the county recorder, the county collector. But let me assure you that you're paying it. I may be the guy that's writing the check and paying the property tax and directly paying it, but I'm collecting it from you as a renter. I'm collecting it from you as the student that attends school. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And public school is costing $7,000 per child to educate. Homeschool costs under $600. Parochial school is half that. I mean, you can send your kid to private school for half that. You know, if we abolished the public school system, took the same amount of money, and just gave it to each child on a per capita basis, handed them $7,000, you could go pay that to the Catholic Church and put $3,500 in your pocket and get a hell of a lot better education in the bargain. Now, this is why, especially since the court's 2002 decision finding school vouchers in Cleveland to be constitutional, the debate is really about money. This argument is irrelevant for those who can afford school choice, an option most often exercised by living in the school district or even within the attendance area of a school of choice. The common remark that the three most important factors in the value of a home are location, location, location. And that often translates for couples with children into school. Low-income parents can afford neither the option of a non-public school nor residence in an acceptable school district. They are the captives of the local school system. There's your inner city public schools educating your child to the 28th percentile. To have a constitutional right without the ability to afford it is no right at all. A comparable example existed when many states required citizens to pay a poll tax before they could exercise their right to vote. That was a device to keep the poor and the low-income minorities from voting. That has been ruled unconstitutional. Similarly, making the right to school choice contingent upon the ability to pay keeps low-income parents from exercising not one, but two constitutional rights, a school of their choice and freedom of religion. Stephen Ahrens has been studying this issue for decades, as far back as 1976, and he points out that conditioning the provision of government benefits upon the sacrifice of fundamental rights has been held unconstitutional before. Few opponents of public funding of school choice have their children in a school where as many as 80% of the students drop out, or where there is violence, or where there is drugs, or a real example where the police are called more than 220 times from September to March during a school year, and yet they compel other people's children to accept such conditions. Now, this is not merely unjust, it's immoral. Those who can afford school choice are not criticized because they select a school that is nearby or has a religious affiliation or because they don't make a wise decision. Only low-income parents are so challenged, and as if wisdom is a matter of having money, are there no affluent fools? Schools should be more than economic prisons for the poor. Not least of all because their children are those with whom the public system has had the least success. The resulting burden is not only on these children and on their parents, but on society in general, and each of us in particular as taxpayers. When a child attends a school system spending $10,000 per pupil per year, as many urban districts do, and then drops out in the 10th grade, he or she not only suffers a lifelong penalty because of an inadequate education, the public has paid $10,000 for no good purpose. And further, we too will pay a lifelong penalty because such dropouts will likely spend most of their lives on the economic fringes of society, either on welfare or in our prisons, and they do not make contributions through taxes or otherwise that they otherwise might. The awareness is slowly growing that school choice is a moral issue where equal justice for all is imperative. Now, we have created a system of school finance that provides free choice for the rich and compulsory socialization for everyone else. The result and the present method of financing American education discriminates against the poor and the working class and even a large part of the middle class by conditioning the exercise of First Amendment rights of school choice upon an ability to pay, while simultaneously eroding the ability to pay through the regressive collection of taxes used exclusively for government schools. You know who wrote that? That was David W. Kirkpatrick again. This is school report number 691, School Choice. Remember, he's a senior education fellow. www.freedomfoundation.us. That's www.freedomfoundation.us if you want to get to him personally. Let's see. Why don't you try his email at kirkdw. It's all one word there, KIRKDW, at AOL.com. All right, let me give you an important reminder here at the midway point. You've been listening to the Law Hours and Editorial Review. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you'd like to order yours, just call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. It's area code 417-273-4967. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the Gordon website, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these law hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The law hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the law hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events. And we do that 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. That's because most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review per se, nor vice versa. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School Direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, that's the website, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Before I close, I'd like to bring your attention to another publication called School Reform News. School Reform News, published by the Heartland Institute. I'm in Volume 9, Number 6, June 2005. And there's an article here that I wanted to bring to your attention. And it's called Violence in Public Schools, A Dirty Secret. Reported decreases in violence may be a matter of underreporting, not progress in combating violence in the public schools. This is an article by Neil McCluskey. Neil McCluskey. And let's see if we've got a McCluskey here. Neil McCluskey, NMCCLUSKEY at cato.org. Is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute Center for Educational Freedom. Imagine that you would get, that's his email there, it's NMCCLUSKEY. It's simply his initial name, it's Neil McCluskey. And it's at cato.org, that's an easy one, NMCCLUSKEY at cato.org. Listen to this story. In March, the public was startled by the news of a horrific shooting spree in Red Lake, Minnesota, where 16-year-old Jeff Wise, or Weiss, killed 7 people and wounded at least 13 others at Red Lake High School before taking his own life. It was the deadliest school shooting since Columbine in 1999. In mid-April, the sexual assault of a 16-year-old special education student by a group of boys at a high school in Columbus, Ohio, which school officials tried desperately to keep under wraps for more than a month, made headlines across the country. The principal was fired, and 3 assistant principals suspended without pay for failing to report the incident to police. One of the girl's assailants videotaped it. Can you believe that? That one of the boys in the school videotaped the rape of a special education girl, probably mentally retarded or something on that order. Just a few weeks later, the parents of 19 Philadelphia elementary school students were shocked to learn that their children had been stabbed by an 8-year-old classmate wielding a hypodermic needle and had to wait 3 hours before receiving medical attention. All had to be tested for HIV, and one student's preliminary results were positive. How do you like that? This is violence going on in your public schools. This is violence that can be eliminated in your own private home school. Now, failing to report problems. These stories give parents, students, and policymakers cause for concern. And they're just a few examples of a broader school violence program. Overall violence in U.S. schools and the government's inability to stop it, even when using new initiatives designed specifically for that purpose, is a big issue in school districts across the country. The public schools have been turned into virtual prisons, with metal detectors and fences and gates and barbed wire over the top and razor wire around these schoolyards. You have to have identification. It is, without a doubt, a police state school. Police state school is where you're sending your children to public school. And according to the April 27th issue of Education Week, a February report by a Cleveland-based firm, National School Safety and Security Services found 86% of the 758 school officers surveyed said crimes at their schools were underreported. Did you get that? 86% of the 758 school officers surveyed said crimes at their schools were underreported. 78% said they had personally taken weapons from students in the past year. From reading the news, it would appear violence and danger are constant companions for America's school children. Though federal reports say school violence has been cut in half over the past decade, some analysts fear that could be because fewer administrators are willing to report these crimes, not because violence has actually fallen off. Now, for the U.S. Department of Education to tell the American education community and public in general that school crime is declining is misleading. The firm's president, Kenneth S. Trump, told the magazine. The assessment has been corroborated by several independent journalists around the country. For instance, in April, the Denver Post examined massive underreporting of violent incidents in Denver area schools, underreporting that occurred despite the presence of a state accountability system designed to identify dangerous schools. The problem in Colorado and elsewhere is that many schools simply do not report violent incidents. And there's a growing consensus. In reality, disclosures of school violence vary wildly from one district to another. Some schools report every punch thrown on the playground. Others did not include assaults that police classified as felonies, Denver Post staff writer Doug Opplinger reported. After comparing police reports with those filed by schools, Opplinger found serious discrepancies among the incidents that took place at metro area schools, reporting no violence or fights of any kind last year, where a boy who needed staples to close head wounds, a girl who was hospitalized with bruised kidneys, a sexual assault, a knifing, and attacks with a flagpole and a baseball bat. Now, between March and April, the Chicago Tribune reported on the failure of law enforcement officials in Illinois to consistently notify school districts when convicted juvenile sex offenders enroll in their schools. Many failed to notify principals in the mistaken belief that they were not permitted to alert them, when in fact they were required to do so. In one case reported in the Tribune, an East Peoria school wasn't informed that a convicted 16-year-old sex offender had enrolled there until a 7-year-old victim's teenage brother told his mother that the assailant was in the gym class, and the mother told the school. Now, that's because they fear the results, and I'm just one person in Peoria, the mother told the Tribune. If my son's assailant fell through these cracks, how many other children, how many of the kids are out there that these schools don't know about? In School Violence and No Child Left Behind, Best Practices to Keep Kids Safe, a January 2005 report from the Reason Public Policy Institute, Education and Child Welfare Director Lisa Snell examined school violence and the inadequacy of government systems to protect children. Her report focuses in particular on the No Child Left Behind Act, which includes provisions enabling students to transfer from persistently dangerous public schools to those designated as safe. While in theory the idea is a good one, in practice it hasn't worked as intended, according to Snell's report anyway. Very few children have gotten the opportunity to leave the dangerous schools because evidence suggests that schools have unreasonable definitions of dangerous, underreport school crime, and they do not provide parents with accurate information about school crime, Snell wrote. And they're watering down the data. When asked how the U.S. Department of Education is working to strengthen the persistently dangerous schools provisions of the No Child Left Behind bill, Maud Zaleski, Associate Assistant Secretary of the Department's Safe and Drug-Free Schools Office, said one of the biggest hurdles faces, or NCLB faces, is improving state and district data collection. The schools aren't passing the truth on to the collection agencies, boys and girls. They're hiding it. Now, when the law was first passed in 2001, states often found some of their districts collected good data on school violence, while others did not. That, Maud Zaleski said, forced states to define dangerous using lowest common denominator data. Is that the best way of doing things? Well, probably not, he said, but he added that was the best way, or that was the best that could be done with the available data that they had. The department is currently working with states to boost data collection systems. In her report, Snell offered 10 recommendations for improving public school safety, including better data collection and reporting. Among those solutions, though, was one that Maud Zaleski did not mention, eliminating state and federal restrictions on school choice. How would it be if this school choice thing was expanded so that every parent and every child in America could choose what school they wanted to go to? Do you think that those people could figure out for themselves what a dangerous school was? You know, just think about it, you know, for a minute. Could you figure out whether or not you wanted to keep sending your child back to the school that he's going to right now? Or would you change schools? What if you had the choice and you had the money that's being spent on the public schools anyway? The money that you're paying, that $7,000 a year that you're paying, boys and girls? What if you had that money in your grubby little fist right this minute? Could you send your child to a school for $7,000 a year that you would approve of, that you could determine to be safe? Could you do that as a parent, all by yourself, without any bureaucrat helping you, as illiterate and dumbed down as you are, mom and dad? I mean, could you figure that out? You know, I say it's time to wake up and smell the roses or smell the coffee here. I want to suggest to you that you subscribe to the School Reform News. That's just one article out of many. Let's see how many pages are in the School Reform News. 18, 19, 20 pages, newsprint format. I don't know what the price is. Why don't you call them and find out? Let me see if we can find the School Reform News. It's published by the Heartland Institute. And the Heartland Institute publishes two other papers. One of them deals with the environment. Here we go. The School Reform News is published 11 times a year by the Heartland Institute, and subscriptions are $36 a year. You can order online at www.heartland.org. Heartland Institute is a nonprofit, nonpartisan. I got a hyphen in there. Nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy research organization serving the nation's federal and state elected officials, journalists, and Heartland members and other opinion leaders. Its activities are tax exempt under Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code. Well, I don't pay taxes, so it's not relevant to me, but if you pay taxes and you want to take your $36 off, it's tax deductible. www.heartland.org. How's that? www.heartland.org. There's their webpage. School reform news is available on the internet. Point your web browser to. Shucks, you know, maybe you can get the thing free. I don't know. I'm not computer literate. I'm one of those computer illiterates they keep talking about. I don't have health insurance. Can't use a computer. And I'm not complaining. Just telling you. Okay, Heartland Institute over here. And I wanted to give this guy, McCluskey, let me give you his email address here. McCluskey, it's N for Neil, McCluskey, at cato.org. He is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute Center for Educational Freedom. And I'll just bet you that these people here, I mean, if you got onto their webpage, I'll just bet you that they could tell you how to figure out how to open your own home school. And they can also teach you how to defend. You know, if you've got overzealous public school officials threatening and trying to bully you, I mean, these guys could tell you where to go to get the information that you need. All right, let me give to you one last item over here. You ever heard of That's Outrageous from Reader's Digest? Well, here's Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson, he's a conservative. He's on PBS. Reading, cheating, and arithmetic. It's a 10th grader's dream. Your teacher catches you cheating and your parents take your side. That's exactly what happened last December to a group of sophomores at Piper High School in Piper, Kansas. Teacher Christine Pelton had assigned her students a semester-long biology project. When the kids turned in their papers, Pelton found that almost a quarter of her students, 28 out of 118, had been plagiarized. And not only plagiarized, but plagiarized poorly. According to Pelton, entire sections of the papers were identical, copied from the same internet websites. She had already warned her students about cheating and its consequences. So each of the 28 offenders received a zero on the assignment and a failing grade in the class, but only temporarily. You see, soon parents of the 28 students who had cheated complained to the local school board, refusing to believe their child had cheated. The penalty, all the parents said, was too harsh, and the school board agreed. And Pelton was instructed to give the cheaters partial credit for their work. The cheaters were thrilled. And the next day, Pelton told the Kansas City Star, "I went to my class and tried to teach the kids, but they were whooping and hollering and saying, 'We don't have to listen to you anymore.'" Her authority gone, Pelton did the only thing that she could. She immediately quit in protest. Most teachers do not. At many high schools and universities, cheating is routine. Teacher apathy is normal. A series of studies by Rutgers University professor Donald McCabe found that on most campuses, more than 75% of students cheat. And why wouldn't they? According to McCabe, a 1999 survey of 1,000 faculty members at 21 colleges found that one-third of those who were aware of student cheating in their courses in the last 2 years did absolutely nothing to address it. Now remember, cheating violates thou shalt not steal. These public school institutions are not teaching their children not to steal. They are amoral at best and immoral at worst. Now, the internet has made plagiarism particularly tempting because dozens of websites with names like schoolsucks.com offer pre-written term papers for sale at bargain prices. Need 5,000 words on feminist consciousness and gender roles in pre-Columbian Latin America? It's only a mouse click away. On the other hand, so is discovery technology. Technology has made catching cheaters just as easy. Several websites offer software that automatically compares the text of a student's work against a database of thousands of term papers and published books and articles. If there's a match, there's likely plagiarism. Last year, a physics professor at the University of Virginia ran 1,850 of his students' papers through a service called Turnitin.com, spelled Turnitin.com. He came up with 122 cases of plagiarism. Christine Pelton used the same service to catch the 28 plagiarists in her class. Over the past few years, dozens of colleges have begun using similar software, but some haven't. Why? Well, because policing plagiarism might hurt a cheater's self-esteem. Did you get that? It might hurt a cheater's self-esteem. When Columbia considered buying anti-plagiarism software, some opposed the idea. They said catching cheaters shouldn't be a hang-them-out-to-dry process, but rather an educational one, said Kathleen McDermott. She's the Associate Dean of Academic Affairs in an interview with the Columbia Daily Spectator. Her colleague, Sandra Johnson, the Associate Dean of Student Affairs, agreed. Columbia should deal with cheaters in a more sensitive, enlightened way, Johnson explained. Now, do you remember Zach Montgomery a couple weeks back? Remember, he said, and gave a little treatise in chapter 11, he says, here's the anatomy, or the analogy, in the anatomy of a criminal. The inmates at San Quentin, remember, in 1880 or thereabouts, all of them had been educated in the public schools. All the young ones had been. And all of these students are being educated in this immoral and amoral environment in public school. Should it be any surprise to us that crime abounds in America? Hell, crime was flourishing in the 1880s. And Zach Montgomery said, hey, boys and girls, the cause is public school. Well, listen to Tucker Carlson, who wrote this article in the Reader's Digest. He's telling you the same thing. As the director of the writing program at Syracuse University, Howard Wood, you'd think, abhor plagiarism above all academic sins. Sure, she feels obliged to say that it's wrong to download someone else's work in total. But in the end, she sounds more like a skillful apologist in her telling students, plagiarize not because they're dishonest and lazy, but because they're tired, and many of them are working long hours at outside jobs and henpecked by perfectionist teachers. We deprive them, Howard writes, of a respectful audience if we tear apart the style, grammar, and mechanics of their papers, marking every error without discussing with them why it matters. Well, Darcy Jones, a human performance major at San Jose State, summed up her opposition to anti-plagiarism programs this way. The software is probably here for the right purpose, she told the student daily, but it totally hurts a person's right to choose whether or not they want to plagiarize. Now, here's a student. And her statement is, the software is probably here for the right purpose, she told the student daily, but it totally hurts a person's right to choose whether or not they want to plagiarize. Well, then, does this mean that a person's right to choose plagiarism? You know, laugh if you want to. But cheating just may be the next civil right. Kind of like sodomy. All right, I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Remember, The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. We'll have something new, some new topic that we'll be talking about. So, until then, we'll see you back here tomorrow night, God willing, of course. So, until then, good night, friends.